Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and before I get to introducing my guest today, I just wanted to say I hope all who are listening to this are safe and well home, and hopefully self-isolation is not driving you too mental at the moment. You may also be relieved to hear, as this interview was recorded in early February, that there is no coronavirus chat whatsoever. Now, to introduce my guest, who on this episode is horror author Lex H. Jones, who I talked to about his first horror book for children, The Old One and the Sea. In the interview, I talked to him about what inspired him to give children's fiction a shot, how the story developed, and how privileged he was to have his book picked as the first title in the Sinister Horror Company's new kids range. Plus, we get into his writing inspirations, whether he thinks things are more watered down for kids nowadays, and why he thinks Lovecraft is having a particularly zeitgeisty moment once again. Before we get to the interview, though, I would just like to quickly remind you the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on Spotify. But now, on to the interview with Lex. Hi, Lex. Nice to have you on the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, we're here to talk about your book, The Old One and the Sea. So, first of all, just for the listeners at home, give us a little synopsis of what the old one in this. I was going to say the old man in the sea. Sorry, yep. the old one in the sea is about.
Okay, well, it's basically a children's book. It's an illustrated book, and it's a reimagining of H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos retold for children. But when I say that, it's not like a really cutesy, silly sort of story. It is a genuine story with real like emotion to it and proper characters and a proper narrative. It's just reframing something that you think you already know for a different audience, basically. But it's still got a lot of sort of reference to the wider Lovecraft mythos, and people who, like adults who are familiar with Lovecraft will probably take a lot from it as well. But at the same time, it allows children to take an interest in these stories in a way that's acceptable to their age range.
What first inspired you to write a children's book in particular?
Strangely, I was discussing just the concept of whether or not it could be done with a different author, and the more we started talking about it, the more I thought you could actually do this. You could genuinely do this as a serious story, not like a really silly, childish one, but you could actually make a serious story from this, because I think if you're doing any kind of adaptation for children, and it's an adaptation of existing work, you need to kind of think, what can you extract from it that keeps the key elements of the story but makes it suitable for children? So like if it's something like the Saw films, for instance, it's very difficult to reframe something like that for children because the violence and the gore of it is like 90% of what the film is. Whereas with something like Lovecraft, there's a lot of mythology in there that you can reframe in a way that's suitable for children. You just take some of the more horrific elements out of it and just tone a few things down. But the wider concepts and monsters and everything like that is certainly something that you can do for children. So what once I decided that it was physically possible to do, the ideas just started rolling then. And then I was introduced to a professional illustrator and who was really interested in joining the project. And it just sort of went from there.
So how did the story develop? What inspired the story, and why particularly Lovecraft did you decide to go for Lovecraft?
But again, it just came from that conversation as to whether or not you could do it, because I'm a big fan of Lovecraft, as I know a lot of my contemporaries are, and it was just about how his work is interpreted today and you know, the value of remakes or reboots and telling things in a different format. And it was also something that I didn't think had been done widely, particularly in a serious way for children. So I just wanted to see if I could give it a go. And starting with the Cthulhu story seemed the best one, like the best entry point for doing a children's Lovecraft book. And I just worked in a few other elements from there, but it's had a really good response. So I'm probably going to do another one. I'm thinking of setting the next one based on the At the Mountains of Madness story, which is slightly more of a complex story than the Cthulhu mythos. But it's, again, I think there's elements there that you can take to adapt it into the kind of story for children.
How difficult was it trying to find the balance in terms of like, pushing the horror so far and, you know, toning it down in certain parts?
Well, I do think children can handle more than people think they can. I think there's a tendency to tone things down too much. And I think if you look at the sort of films that was around for children, like in the 80s in particular, in the sort of the era that I was growing up, compared to the films that are made for children now, it seems like there's virtually nothing that comes out now that isn't a Disney film. Whereas, you know, I would have had films like The Goonies and Back to the Future and Labyrinth and Gremlins and things that technically they're not designed for children, but they became known as films that like children would watch. And we don't really do that with films anymore. And I think with books, you kind of have that freedom because it's something a child can do on its own. Chances are if a kid's watching a film, it's because the parents have taken them to see it. Whereas with the book, you know, there's more of a solitary thing there. So I think it's better to push the boundaries a little bit as to what you can do. So with regards to finding that balance, it was a case of, okay, don't have anything in this that's blatantly like adult, but at the same time, don't talk down to the audience and understand, try and remember what it was like to be a child and how patronizing it was when everything sort of spoke to you with that child voice.
Do you think in a way we kind of talk down more nowadays? Because I realized that we're of the same age, and you mention those kind of movies like Goonies and Gremlins, and you know, even some of the kind of Steven Spielberg films, like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark has, you know, Nazis having their faces melted off, you know, Jurassic Park has the, you know, the Velociraptor scene in the kitchen, you know, like there's things like that. And there's a bunch of movies that you can reference from our childhood that you can be like, they had scary moments, but they were, you know, still suitable for children.
Sure. Yeah. So what was the question? Sorry, do you think that we talk down more in our pop culture?
We tone things down now more than we used to.
I think so. I think so. Yeah, and I think I'm not going to blame the internet, but I think there's definitely like a perception problem in that everyone thinks everything is worse than it is because of the internet. I mean, you get that with outside of the world of fiction, you get that with crime. You know, when we were kids, you'd go out and play on the streets and you'd go and call on your friends and you'd come back 6 hours later for dinner and you wouldn't even have a mobile phone. Whereas now, you know, you wouldn't even dream of doing that with your children. You'd ferry them everywhere in the car and they'd have contact with you 24/7 and you'd know where they were every minute of the day and whose house they were at and what they were doing and what time they were coming back. And you know, because the perception is there's like a pervert on every corner who's going to stuff them on a van. But the only reason people think that is because you hear about so much now. Because it's not just local news and the national news. You hear about everything that happens. So it gives this perception that more of it is happening, which then is an incorrect perception, which then makes people think the world's got worse, which makes people think they've got to protect the children from everything rather than exposing them to some of it. And I think that is all part of why kids' films now are so sanitized compared to what we would have grown up with.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, because the world is smaller now. You know, you hear,
yes, absolutely.
Like you say, you know, you don't just hear what's happening in your town, county, whatever, and on the, you know, your country. You hear like everything, and it is, yeah. You're right. There is there's just that you just taking in far more information than that you would have before, and a lot of it's very scary, because like there is many scary things in the world, but then when you kind of, but there's always been many scary things in the world, and
you just didn't know about as much of it.
Yeah. absolutely.
Yeah.
In terms of, were you at all concerned about the Lovecraft element? Obviously Lovecraft has a great legacy, but a controversial legacy as well, in terms of like different parts of his personality.
Yes.
And particularly in relation to his views on race. And
yeah,
were you at all concerned about kind of perpetrating a soft, fluffy image of Lovecraft that, you know, obviously there is ugly parts there?
Yeah, the way I got around that is that it's quite clearly in no way, I should point out, and obviously you've read the book, the child who is the protagonist in the book is basically like a fictional version of a little Lovecraft when he was little, but it's in no way accurate. Nothing about it is an accurate depiction of him. It's not biographical in any way. His, you know, the name of him and his family members is correct, but like everything else is quite clearly fictional. You know, I didn't bother to research like the name of the school he went to or the town he lived in or anything at all like that. It's a completely fictional place. It's a fictional version of him. It's, you know, taking a couple of elements that are real, like his name and the fact that he liked telling stories. But beyond that, it's in no way a real version of him. So I don't think it's sort of glamorizing the character or anything like that, because it's not really him. It's as much a fictional version of him as the fictional characters that he created. It's you know, it's in no way biographical. Yeah. And it doesn't, it also keeps well out of anything to do with that, really, because I think Lovecraft's views kind of slip through in some of his stories when you start talking about, you know, mixing of bloodlines and all this sort of thing. And there's nothing like that in there. It's about a big monster that comes out of the sea. So it stays well away from the more controversial aspects of his views that you start seeing slip into some of his stories, because like you said, it's about his legacy as a writer. And I think you can, whether or not you can separate the artist from the art is an ongoing debate, and I'm not one for book burning. I think if we start emptying our shelves of every author who had troubling views, we're going to have nothing on there that wasn't written in the last 2 months, and even then it's only going to be by specific people who match what views we've decided to correct this week. I think it's a very troubling attitude to have, to start chucking everything in the bin. But of course there is a line as to like how bad does a person have to be. I mean, we wouldn't read and purchase books now that were written by a blatant Nazi, but you can still buy Mein Kampf. So it's a very complicated debate, but I think the important thing for me, and I can only do it for me, is to not glamorize the negative aspects of this person. So at no point is it saying, hey, this guy was great, look at him. It's taking his work and saying his work was great, and I've put a fictional version of a childhood of him in it. But there's nothing about that that would make you think it was meant to be a homage to him as an adult human being.
So you almost deliberately avoided researching into his childhood?
Well, I know about him because I've read quite a lot of stuff about him. I just deliberately didn't make it accurate. So it's set in a fictional place. It's sort of suggested it's set in England when obviously Lovecraft was America. Mm-hmm. It's got his mother right, but with regards to the specific details of his childhood and everything, nothing about it is real. It's a fictional little boy who happens to have the same name, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's understandable. I'm not necessarily for banning books or taking things off the shelf just because people have kind of troubling aspects of their personality, which, you know, like you say, it's a lot of works by many 20th century authors, famous 20th century authors, would be excluded if that was the bar. You know, and like you say, I think there is certain lines that maybe you're like, well, you know, we can leave that off now. But yeah,
it's a moving goalpost as well, isn't it? So yeah, it's very difficult to say, okay, this is the list of boxes that a person's got to have ticked in order for their work to be acceptable for us to finding a library in 2020. Because by 2025, there'll be another 6 things on that list. So people who are acceptable now won't be then. So it's a dangerous road to go down. I'm not one for censorship as a rule. I think once you start pushing that too far, it's a choppy waters to be swimming in.
Absolutely. And as long as you're it, like you do in the book, like you said, I have read the book, so I know that you're very much celebrating the work and not the person.
Yes.
So, you know, like, yeah. You know, the other interest.
No way. Sorry, go on.
No, you could. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, yeah, there's no way anyone would interpret that as an actual biographical childhood of Howard Lovecraft.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I was going to say was, do you have any kind of thoughts on why Lovecraft seems to be kind of so popular again? Like, for example, you know, at the recently, I can't remember if it was last year or the year before, I saw a play at the Fringe about Lovecraft. There's been several films in recent years. There was The Void, Mandy, Color Out of Space is coming out soon. There seems to be a real upsurge in Lovecraftian shit, you know, like whether it be films. Do you have any thoughts on why it's kind of captures our moment or is, you know, still feels contemporaneous?
I think it's not so much that it's suddenly come out. I think it's more like it's come back because I think things go in cycles. Like, there was a period in the 80s where there was quite a lot of films that have Lovecraftian elements to them. I mean, even like the Hellraiser films, for instance, you know, because, and I think that the reason, and also you've got things like From Beyond and the Evil Dead films and, you know, various franchises. And I think the reason he got popular to start with is because of the different view of the supernatural that we got, because around that time that, you know, the turn of the century, a lot of horror stories were very, very sort of comfortably within a stereotypically Christian view of the supernatural. So you've got, you know, angels, but then you've got ghosts and demons and that kind of thing. And yeah, you might have vampires, but they're afraid of the cross, and it's all very neatly tied in with Christian view of the world. Whereas Lovecraft had this idea of there is no God, there is no devil, there is no heaven and hell, but there are these ancient things that existed long before we did, and they're still out there, and at some point they're going to wake up and they're not going to be happy about the ants that are crawling all over their creation. And you know, that is a very different idea. It completely, Christianity puts us, and all stories based within Christian philosophy, puts humanity on something of a pedestal, in that we're kind of special and God's got our back, so we can use things like the cross and holy water and all of that. You can't do jack shit against the things Lovecraft created. We are nothing compared to them. We're not special. We're no more of a threat to them than like a domestic dog would be. It completely strips away that big safety net of God having your back that is present in a lot of sort of supernatural fiction. And I think that was stood out quite a lot, and probably still does, to be honest, because particularly with a lot of horror films over the last few years, with, you know, things like the Conjuring franchise, again, it sits very comfortably within a Christian philosophy. Mm-hmm. So anything that stands out that completely removes that and says, nah, you can't just read from a book and send this thing away, you just got to run and hope it doesn't follow you. There's and even that might not be enough if it's something big enough to devour the entire planet. You know, it completely is a different form of horror. And I think one of the reasons we've got more films and stuff about it lately is probably a practical sense that it's possible to do now with the special effects that we've got.
I was just thinking as well, I mean, like you say, it was also very popular in the 80s.
Yes.
The Evil Dead, the Reanimator, and all that, the Hellraiser. Do you think there's a certain... Obviously, in the 80s, there was Thatcherism, and there was the Cold War, and all the nuclear threat. And, you know, we're obviously living in sort of troubled times now. Do you think there's a certain part of the nihilism of Lovecraftian tales that appeals to troubled times?
I think so. I think that's a very valid point, yeah. I was thinking, actually, as you were asking that question, I thought there is like a nihilistic tendency, isn't there, with regards to when this stuff is popular, mm-hmm. as opposed to perhaps more hopeful sort of horrors, if you like, where there is a way out. I mean, vampires are scary, but you can get in your house and they can't come in unless you ask them to. Or you can grab a cross, or you can put two sticks together in the shape of a cross. Or, you know, the idea that the ultimate top-level being in the universe is on your side is something of a protection when it comes to things like vampires or demons. But you take that away and you've got nothing, and there's a hopelessness there. And it's that is very much a running theme in Lovecraft, which, as you say, I think in times when people are worrying about, particularly with bigger things like climate change, particularly of the last decade, that is a massive overwhelming force that you or I mean, we can change our diet and we can recycle stuff, but ultimately, while you've got mega corporations churning out what they churn out and refusing to change anything, what you or I do in our diets or our house counts for nothing. It's like an overwhelming force that you're ultimately powerless against. And that is a very Lovecraftian sort of thing.
Kind of on the political issue as well, I mean, whether it was intended or inadvertent, or I'm not sure, but it seemed like your book kind of pointed to our troubled times right now in the thematically, in terms of its kind of message of fear making monsters of us all.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's important because I obviously in the real world, depending on your belief system, but for me personally, there aren't any monsters or anything like that. The monsters are people. And I think what makes people monsters is often circumstances beyond their control. And I think history shows time and again that, this is even a line in the Christmas Carol, isn't it? Ignorance is what, you know, creates the worst aspects of man, isn't it? Ignorance, and that leads to fear, and fear makes people act in awful ways. And I think that's true of every time period in history. But I think particularly when things are, you know, times of hardship and everything and lack of knowledge, and particularly when you get people like, you know, I don't know your individual persuasions, but from my perspective, when you get people like the Tory party and like the Republican party who sow that deliberately, that fear of the other, that those people are different from you, worry about them, don't focus on what we're doing, and that kind of thing makes people the worst version of themselves.
I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, obviously I don't want to go too far down that road.
Of course, it's not a politics podcast.
A politics podcast, it's a horror podcast. I will tell my listeners, though, that I'm unashamedly left-wing, so you can come at me if you want, but...
So am I.
But we'll move on.
After the Brexit thing, I was sort of hoping that Yorkshire would be able to join up with Scotland and just leave the rest of them to it, to be honest.
We'll all join up all the disparate parts. And we'll, you know, we'll attach ourselves to Ireland, and you can attach yourself to us, and we'll. But that's We'll move on from Brexit. how quickly did this story come together? Once you had that initial idea, and you know you thought like, yeah, this can be done. I think this is possible. Was it quite a quick process or?
No, it was kind of patchwork, to be honest. I had to sort of think what elements I wanted to include of it and what sort of scenes I wanted to include and what the through narrative was going to be. And I also had to think of a setting, and that kind of came before I'd thought of the full narrative. I'd always liked this. I like out-of-season seaside resorts. I just think there's kind of like a sad magic to them. You know, these places that at one point were the height of, you know, popularity for holidays and joy and noisy families and all that. And now, particularly if you go out of season, they're kind of quiet and a bit run down. And I don't know, there's just kind of a special spark to them. Like when you see like a Ferris wheel and no one's on it or something like that. There's just something about there's kind of a sad romance to it. And I've always wanted to set a story in like a rundown seaside town. And then this story obviously needed to be set by the sea. So that just came together perfectly. And then as soon as I thought, I'll call it Innsmouth. And you know, again, it doesn't bear any resemblance to the Innsmouth that Lovecraft writes about, but it's another little Easter egg. And yeah, the setting just made so much of it just flow together from then onwards. And the kind of the characters then built themselves up in my brain, and I decided who the key players were going to be and what their role was going to be. And I didn't decide how it was going to end or anything until quite late on, to be honest. I just sort of started writing it and worked towards the scenes that I'd already pictured quite vividly in my head, and then just saw where was a natural place for this story to go.
That's very interesting that you didn't see the ending to it, because having read it, I don't want to spoil the ending, I would say that, you know, when it all comes together at the end, it beautifully ties in with the Cthulhu mythos, and you know, and just the way you do it, I think is really, really quite wonderful. So I thought that maybe you always had that in mind to kind of tie in with Lovecraft's work, but no, that was
thank you for the compliment there, but that was quite a late decision to do what does happen at the end, which I'll not spoil either, but yeah, that was quite a late field decision, to be honest. But as you say, I'm very pleased with how that worked out as well. And I suppose that was always going to be the ending, really. I'm not sure how else I could have done it. But that it was not. I did quite often in the work that I do, I sometimes do have the ending in mind and sort of work backwards. But that this was not the case with this one.
In terms of like calling it Innsmouth and stuff, was that something fun for you to do? Of like in terms of, I mean, I suppose a lot of the presumably the parents who might pick this up for their kids presumably are maybe fans of Lovecraft and. Was that something you had in mind that you were going to have like these kind of Easter eggs for like fans of Lovecraft that they can be like the parents can get as much enjoyment as the kid?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, there's loads of stuff. Like I know full well that the kids who read that book won't think anything of the fact that the town's called Innsmouth. I could have called it anything and they wouldn't have thought anything of it. But the parents who read it or who read it to them or with them, like you say, I assume many of them will be Lovecraft, and I know a lot have been based on the reviews and stuff that I've read. So I think that's definitely something for them, those little references to other stories and things. And there's even some really specific ones if people are massive Lovecraft fans. Like there is one scene in the book where they meet some sailors, and those sailors charted a particular sea voyage where they had encountered something. And in my book, where it talks about that ship and the bearings on the sea where they had this encounter, the coordinates, that is all accurate according to Lovecraft's original story.
Well, that's
so things like that, you know, if you're a particular fan of little Easter eggs and stuff, then I think you'll like that one.
Obviously this horror book for kids. How did you get into horror yourself? Have you been a horror fan since you were a child? And Was it through movies? Was it through books?
Yeah, I always have been. It's always been like my through line, really. You know, like when you're a child and you kind of, to some degree, you're into whatever is thrown at you. So, you know, this year it's Transformers and the next year it's Turtles and the year after it's He-Man or whatever. But there's always some things which, you know, it might be football or whatever, that there's something that no matter what other thing you're into, you still like this thing regardless. And my sort of through line like that was always horror stuff. Like I liked graveyards and castles and fog and creepy forests and anything with ghosts and vampires and anything like that was always my thing. That was always my like thing that I was obsessed with. So yeah, books, toys, comic books, films, everything I could get my hands on. I remember what I had, that stereotypical friend when I was a child who was a couple of years older than me, so I would often get to see films through him before I was technically old enough to watch them, because he was that kind of pet kid who he was like the I don't know if you're a Simpsons fan, but he was like the Nelson Muntz sort of boy. Oh, so yeah. He had parents who didn't give a crap, which as a kid you think is amazing, but then you look back as an adult and think, oh, that's not as good as I thought it was. But he had the sort, you know, he had the sort of parents who at 8 years old he'd be watching a horror film rated an 18 and they wouldn't care. So, but like obviously when you yourself are 8 years old, you think that's amazing to have a friend who can do that. But it's not until you're older that you look back and see the negative side of that. But of course, as a kid, that meant I had access to a lot of things that earlier than I would have done otherwise. And also my grandfather introduced me to my first proper ghost story when he knew I liked all of this kind of thing, which was the M.R. James story, Whistle and I'll Come to You. He told me that story. And that was my first proper ghost story that I've heard, and I still love it to this day. I actually have a tattoo of the whistle from the story with the quote on it. And it's that was something else that kind of sparked it, because, yeah, I just think it's nice to know that adults like the thing that you like as a kid, which is rare as well. I mean, like, if you're into He-Man as a kid, it's not often you're going to come across an adult who says, oh, I love He-Man too, but with something like horror, that is immediately something that you can share with your dad, or in my case, my granddad. So It just became that thing that I was always into it, and then it was, and then at some point I started writing just for the hell of it, and then started writing horror, and that just seemed a natural fit for me.
And what were other than the M.R. James, what were some of the kind of earliest kind of books and movies that you were like, this horror stuff, this is my bag?
I really liked all the classic sort of Universal Studios horrors, because they had all the tropes that the films of that were coming out when I was a child and that were available on video, which again, you're talking like your Nightmare on Elm Street, your Friday the 13th, your Halloween, all those kind of things. They kind of deliberately abandoned all of the classic horror tropes because they were trying to set a new thing going, which is understandable. You know, the horror of stuff happening in your own street in a suburban neighborhood or a summer camp or whatever. But I wasn't really about that. I liked your castles and your graveyards and your spooky forests and all that. So I was very into the old sort of classic sort of Universal Studios films. And they were also, given the age of them and everything, I was much less likely to, you know, get in trouble for watching them. So it was also much easier to watch those and find them on television at a reasonable hour. And yeah, those were always the kind of things that I loved. But also Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters was probably my earliest introduction to Lovecraft. I mean, the first film in particular has got a very Lovecraftian story arc to it. And even though I didn't obviously knew nothing about Lovecraft at the time, I would probably say Ghostbusters was my first introduction to Lovecraft himself and his ideas.
Absolutely. Yeah, I suppose it does have a very, but particularly the first one. I think it's weird. Like, I think, you know, Ghostbusters is one of those movies that often gets misremembered. And just in terms of, like, you know, people think, it's purely like a comedy and it's for kids. But there's some kind of freaky, you know, for us, particularly when you're kids, there's some freaky scenes in Ghostbusters.
Yes. I think the second one deliberately, after having come out like 5 years later, so we've had the toys, we've had the merchandise, we've had the cartoon. Second one knows that there is like a massive kids audience for this, and I think it leans hard into that. So the second film is much more child friendly. But the first one, like you say, even though it became something that was thought of as a kids film, I really don't think it was made as that.
Yeah, that's true. And there's just some, in the 80s they made some weird stuff that ended up being kind of aimed at kids. It's the same thing with like Gremlins as well. That is very much a film that wouldn't kind of get made now, or it'd be, you know, it might get made, but it certainly wouldn't be kind of aimed at children.
I think it was because in the 80s, and that's probably a hangover from the 70s as well, I think the taboo was around sex stuff. So your film could have as much violence in it as you want, or horrific imagery, and people wouldn't be that bothered about you showing it to your kids, as long as it didn't have a sex scene in it.
I don't know. I was talking about this with my brother just the other day, actually. There seems to be something in that, particularly in like American culture, where they have like really, you know, like in really big hang-ups about sex and swearing. Then you know, you can, you know, don't say the F word or drop a C bomb or anything like that. But you know, like smash a man's face in, that's fine. You know?
Yeah, you can show a live decapitation on screen, but don't swear while you're watching it. Yeah, that's very, very true of American films. Even now, I think, to be honest, I think, you know, they get the ratings based on like how many swears they've got in them and stuff.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah, censorship's weird. Our censorship can be weird as well. Like there's just the when you look into it and the way things get the certifications and, you know, like, if your movie has basically no violence but has like two headbutts in it, that's like automatically a 15, because a headbutt's worse than a punch or a kick or a, but you know, it's like, you know.
Really? Okay, yeah, there's like someone sat there with a spreadsheet and there's all these really bizarre algorithms in it.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, certain things, it's like, oh yeah, that's a 15, that's an 18.
That is odd, but I can totally imagine someone taking that job really seriously. But who decides that? That's why I find censorship troublesome. Who gets to decide that, oh, this is, you know, who makes themselves, in the absence of like a ruling church, which we thankfully don't have in the UK anymore, then, you know, our government is not a religious government or anything like that. Ironically, since we had a monarchy that was, you know, meant to be imposed by God, and America was meant to be a country free from all of that, they've now got presidents who will stand there and talk about God being on their side and that, and our leaders avoid that like the plague, which is ironic really, but in the absence of that, who stands there and says, we are the moral arbiters of this country, we will decide what you should be seeing on screen and shouldn't. I find that a very troublesome topic, that anyone would give themselves that authority.
I don't know. It's some admin guy down at the BBC.
You only need like one overzealous Mary Whitehouse type, don't you? And then no one gets to watch anything.
I think I think that's why we didn't get to see a lot of stuff, or a lot of stuff was banned in the UK for a long time. Because I think
I
think the president of the BBC and you know, with James Furman, like, who's present for a long time, was quite conservative in his views, and had quite a lot of control there, and that's, you know, what led to the kind of video nasties era and like so many things.
I think that probably made some
banned and all that, you know. And
yeah, I remember all that. I think that probably the video nasties thing probably led to some films getting way more popular than they ever would have been if they just released them. Because some of those films were terrible pieces of film, but they got popular because of the, you know, the sort of mythology around them being banned.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't know if you did this or had this at all, but I certainly know I, in my late teens and early 20s, had a phase where I was kind of into like, what's the most extreme horror? What's anything that's like, you know.
Sure.
Seeing all that, and you know, there was the video nasties list, and trying to get through as many of the videos nasties list as possible. And yeah, some of them are totally not worth it. Some of them, like you say, if they weren't on the videos nasties list, they'd be totally, utterly forgotten by history.
About six people would have seen them, and that would have been it. Yeah,
absolutely. Whereas, you know, because they're there, you know, people, you know, pay exorbitant amounts of money to get, you know, them on VHS on eBay and all this kind of stuff.
I think there's like a human instinct thing with that. I think there is. It's like a thing from childhood. Like you can, you know, if you've got a kid sat in a playpen with five toys, you take one of them away, that's the one they immediately want. And I think that's a thing even with adults. You say, you can't watch this film, that is immediately the one everyone wants to go and see.
Absolutely. If you make it kind of, like you say, you know, not only if you take the toy away, but you make it forbidden in some way, you're like, this toy in this corner, you can't touch this one. It's naughty to do that. You're like, why?
Yeah.
Why? I wasn't particularly interested in the toy before, but it looks kind of alluding to me now.
that child will turn into like Sherlock Holmes with the ways in which they will figure out getting hold of that toy after you've said that.
Absolutely. Yeah. But to go back to the your book, I was wondering as well how quickly it came about that you were, did the Sinister Horror Company come to you, or did you go to them, or what was the process there?
I went to them, actually. I'd had a story published by them before, so they were familiar with my work, and they had contacted me before and said that they'd be interested in looking at more of my full-length work, because I don't know if fans is the right word, but they were appreciative of my work, as I am of theirs. I know they put out really good books, and they do it the right way, and pay people properly, and you know, that's a big problem in the publishing world, is, you know, people not getting paid for the work and all that sort of thing. So I'd heard nothing but great things from everyone who'd ever worked with them, which is important. So they were like the top of my list, really, when it came time for seriously looking for a publisher for it. So I sent it to them, and when I'm sending a manuscript to somebody, I like to have done as much of the work as possible for them. So I'm sending them the most, it's like a school project. I want it to be polished. So I'd already paid for it to have a professional edit. I'd already paid for the artists who have done the artwork. So basically it was as, obviously they had final edit choice on it and got to do their own edit, but I wanted it to be as polished. I don't want to send something into someone that looks like I've just finished scribbling it on the back of a napkin. You know, I want it to be as tight as it can be when they pick it up. So they already got quite a polished version of it, and they really liked it and wanted to work with me to bring it up to the finished standard. And we did that over a year or so. And then it came out just before Christmas in 2019. And it's had a really, really good response. It's had reviews from some really sort of like major horror websites, and some of the stuff people are pulling out of it, like professional reviewers, is things that I didn't even necessarily think of when I wrote it. But I love that when you, once you've created something, whether it's a story or a song or whatever, you don't fully own it anymore. And it's not just that thing you wrote. You wrote a song, and to you, it was just about that amazing night out that you had with your mates. Fair enough. But someone else is going to listen to that song, and it's going to be about that night out they first had with the girlfriend, or it's going to be their song that they had the last night they spoke to the father. Or, you know, everyone then adds their own meaning to things and extracts what they want from the lyrics, as they do from story. So some of the stuff people have seen in it, I didn't necessarily put in it myself, but I love when people do that.
What are some of the most interesting observations on the work and reviews, or the most surprising thing that you've read that in a review that you've been like, wow, what was that? I didn't see that in it, but that's kind of cool.
When it talks about grief and how children handle grief, because yes, that is a thing. As the book kicks off, Howard is in a state where his father is necessarily dead, but quite strongly implied to be dead. It's set during World War One, and his father has been declared missing in action, which in that war in particular, 99 times out of 100 meant they weren't coming back. So it's, you know, him and his mother are in a state of grief, and that kind of state of grief where, not the wailing and rendering your clothes state where you've just heard about it, but, you know, a bit of time's passed, but you never really get over that. And particularly with not having that closure of a body or anything, and it kind of leaves you in this strange sort of melancholy state of you've got to carry on as if things are normal, but they're not normal. So that is kind of the backdrop for the story, but it's not what it's about. It's about him meeting this monster and how that changes his life and opens his eyes to secrets of the world that most people don't know about. But the very beginning and the very baseline of this story is dealing with this grief. And I thought that was something that, yeah, it's there, that's the background, and now we'll move on to the story. But so many people have pulled on that in their reviews and talked about the way I wrote childhood grief and how strong that was and how emotional it made them. And I honestly didn't think it was that big a deal, but it seems to have sparked something in a lot of people, which is really touching.
It's yeah, no, I can see that. I think it is quite a emotional, melancholic book, and there's particular certain scenes where I can definitely relate to that. Or you know, not personally, I'm not going through that kind of grief, but you know, like just the sentiment of what they're saying about,
yes,
kind of dealing a child dealing with that sort of grief, particularly when him and Ulu are in the fairground, you know, and that whole scene. And yeah, I feel like it is overall quite an emotional book and quite melancholic, and even, you know, even touches upon with the Mr. Derleth character, you know, kind of post-traumatic stress.
Yes.
He's obviously suffering from, you know.
Yeah, well, he is a character. Obviously, the name was used intentionally, but again, the character is nothing like the August Derleth of real life. But I just think probably one of the great tragedies of our time is how long it took us as a culture or a hemisphere or whatever you want to call it, as the Western world, is how long it took us to start recognizing mental health and doing something about it. And you think particularly with something like World War One, how many broken men came home from that and went on to kill themselves or be physically abusive because they had all this inside them and didn't know what to do with it. You know, I mean, you watch films or read comic books or TV serials or things from like the 1950s, like, so you've got all these men just after World War II, and it's more or less the norm that he hits his wife or something, or that he hits the kids. And it's almost treated as a joke in some things. It's like it's just perfectly accepted that there's this generation of men who've just got back from the war who now smack the wife about it, and that's fine. And I just think, you know, that's, to me, there's got to have been so many men who had problems with anger and rage and loss and the horror that they'd been through and didn't know what to do with that, and no one else knew what to do with that, and things became accepted as normal, which probably shouldn't have been. And we got things like, particularly in Britain, like this stiff upper lip thing and all this absolute nonsense which takes so many men quite literally to the bridge. And it's I think, you know, again, it's not a book about that, but I think to have at least one character in it in a post-World War One situation and have him clearly being affected by it without all the focus being on that, I think it's important to acknowledge that. I don't like the way that we celebrate wars as if they're all this amazing thing and, you know, ignore the damage that was done even to the people who survived it. And as I say, I do think it's a tragedy that it's taken us so long to recognize mental health problems, particularly when the cause of them is so blindingly obvious.
Absolutely. And you make a good point about the you know, the comics and all that from the 50s. I mean, the when you were saying about that, it just made me think of, there was a, I don't know if you'd be aware of it, but there was a newspaper strip in Scotland called Andy Capp, which was
long
running newspaper strip that was about, there was like a comedic newspaper strip that was about a wife beater, like a violent, drunken wife beater. That's, and it was the adventures of this violent, drunken wife. It was very popular for decades. And now you look and you just think, what the fuck?
Yeah, absolutely. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying every guy who was like that in the 50s was as a result of World War II. There was a lot of bigger issues, but I think there will have been a lot of men who did end up coming home with problems with rage and things like that as a result of that, and it was just ignored. And yeah, obviously the character of Mr. Derleth in this book is not like that, but he's clearly been messed up. And he kind of varies between being this slightly forlorn, quiet man sitting outside in the middle of the night staring up at the sky. And then there's a few scenes later on, which I really enjoyed writing, where he kind of snaps back to being like his old self and then goes again. And you know, that I think that's important to show that kind of thing, really. And the damage that war can do even to the survivors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I've said in the podcast before that, you know, I've talked to other people about anxiety and about depression, and I've suffered from that myself. And
shit, same here. Yeah.
So I absolutely think it's brilliant that we talk about mental health much more now, and it's been recognized, and you know, things are being done about it, and there is more discussion and there's more conversation, and you know, depression, things like that are no longer seen as legitimate things, and not just things
yes.
of, like, you know, pull yourself together and yep. you know, you're just a bit sad or whatever that is, you know.
Yeah, I suffer from high function anxiety disorder, so I'm well aware of all of that, but I do think that people talking about it is better, because sometimes just when you have something like that and you can't quite trust your own brain, if that makes sense, hearing someone else say something and you think, I do that, that's what my brain does, or seeing a fictional character who's got the same thing as you, it just makes you aware that, oh, it's not just me, this is a thing that people have. Just like if you're a child who's born with a non-functioning spine, so you're in a wheelchair and you think there's something wrong with you, but then you're watching a cartoon and one of the characters is in a wheelchair. Just things like that. It's important to do that, just so that you don't think that there's just something wrong with you that nobody else in the world has, and it's just you because you're a freak. And I think anything like that, that kind of exposure of these issues and showing that, nope, lots of people have this, and talking about it and getting it out of the shadows that way is beneficial in so many different ways.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. But going back more generally to the book, in terms of you know, being published by the Sinister Horror Company, and it seems like you're the kind of, they now have a children's fiction section on their website, and you're the first one. Yep. Is it kind of cool to be the trailblazer in the new kids range at the Sinister Horror Company?
Yeah, it was a bit of pressure, but yeah, I think if they get more people writing children's versions of either children's versions of existing stories or whole new horror stories aimed at children or anything, I think that's great. And I'd love that they, you know, if they became like the pioneers of that and were known for that, I think that would be a really good thing. And I'd be very, very proud to have a part in that. Because, I mean, as I say, I've got others of myself that I will be writing, and I never ever presume that anyone's going to publish anything I write, but the first port of call for my submission inquiries will be with Sinister again for them. But beyond my work, I hope other people see that new imprint and reach out to them with any ideas of their own, because I think as we said at the start of this podcast, in a world where stuff aimed at children is so sanitized, it's nice that at least one beacon can be shining, saying, you know what, if you're the sort of kid who likes stuff that's a bit weird, come here. You know, I think that's a good thing to be a part of.
Absolutely. And I read that it was I read somewhere that it was going to be the first part of a trilogy. Can you tell us much about books 2 and 3?
See, I don't know if trilogy is the right word. You know how, I assume you're familiar with the what's called the Cornetto trilogy that Simon Pegg and Nick Frost did.
Yes.
In that it's not really a trilogy, is it? But it's sort of thematically linked, and there's a couple of things, you know, it's more like that, in that it's three books that are set in the same world, and there might be a couple of very, very subtle references to stuff that make you aware they're set in the same world, but it's not going to be, here's another thing that Howard Lovecraft did, and then here's another thing. Like, Howard isn't even a character in the second and third book. It's just other things that take place in this world that he then discovers. He might have a cameo in it, or he might be referenced. It might not even be as a child. It might be years later. But it is not just going to be Howard going off on little adventures, meeting other monsters that he would then write about. It's other stuff within the same world that he actually himself wrote about in real life. So the second one is going to be based on At the Mountains of Madness. I'm not saying anything further about it, but it's a reframing of that story. And the third one is going to be about the Dunwich Horror. And what I've done is I've looked at all of Lovecraft's stories, popular or otherwise, and seen which ones I think I could extract the material from to keep the semblance of the story, but redo it in a way that's suitable for children. So, and those are the three that I've thought, the Call of Cthulhu to start with, and then those two, and those are the ones that I've thought. So those are what I'm going to be working on. And all being well, I'll get the same artist to do the artwork. So there's that sort of thematic consistency throughout, and there will be little Easter eggs referencing each story in the later ones, but it's not a sequel in the strictest sense of the word.
And are you purely focused on that at the moment, or are you working on other things in terms of your adult fiction as well?
No, it's always a bit of plate spinning with me. This year we'll see the release of my first collection of short horror stories. I've got various, I'm probably approaching 25 now, short horror stories published in different sort of mixed anthologies with different authors. But this is my first solo collection, where it will be a book of like 10 or 12 of my stories. That's just mine. That's coming out this year. I've also got an occult detective novel that I wrote, which is called The Final Casebook of Mortimer Grimm. That has been released. It's about a supernatural, well, it's about an occult detective who can basically see the supernatural world in Victorian London, and he's helping a ghost named Mortimer Grimm, who was also a detective. He's helping him solve the case that got him killed, in return for Grimm teaching him about the occult world, so he can kind of replace him as London's expert on this sort of thing. So he basically says, in return for helping you solve the case that got you killed, I want you to teach me about all this stuff that you know about. And the two of them work together on that. And the main character is called Detective Chester Harkins. And whilst Grimm, who's the dead character, is very much like a traditional Victorian detective in everything you think of when you say that, Harkins himself is very different. He's much more like an East End, rough and ready sort of street level detective.
Or is it set in kind of contemporary times?
No, it is set in the late Victorian period. It's set in like 1891, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's got what you think of Victorian times, but it's also just starting to encroach on the beginning of the 20th century as well. So it's an interesting period, that. It's also an interesting period in America with the sort of like the death of the Wild West as well, yeah, where it's like you can see one era just starting to come to an end, and the shoots of the next one just starting to sprout up, and it's an interesting period. So I think it's a good period to set a story like that, because you've got one character who's dead and needs to move on, representing the old world that's dying, and you've got this new character who's more representative of the new world. So it's the characters kind of represent that era, if you like.
That sounds very, very interesting. The thing that came to mind, was that it's like Sherlock Holmes meets Randall and Hopkirk deceased.
Yeah, no, that's a fair comparison. It's probably a fair bit darker and more violent than either, but it's, yeah.
I can imagine, but no, that sounds really really good. I take it, is the have you named them? it harkens, is that a deliberate kind of reference to Jonathan Harkins? No.
You mean from Dracula?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's called Jonathan Harker.
Yeah, I just literally remembered that just as I said that. Just as I said that, I was like, no, he's not called Harkins at all. He's Harker. That's I've completely pulled that. I'll move on.
I know what you mean. No, but it's a fair question because, yes, I did want a name that was like, seemed like of that time,
yeah,
but not a name that you've heard in an existing story. But, yes, it did come from that. You're not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just funny because I was thinking, it's Dracula, and then I was thinking, no, that's not. I've made a mistake. Literally, just 2 seconds after I asked the question. Let's finish on me making an idiot of myself.
No, it's honestly, seriously, it did come from that. I wanted to use a name like Harker, but change it slightly because Harker. Yeah.
And that's what tricked me. Well, it's been great talking to you, Lex, and it's been great having you on the show. And feel free to come back again when the other books are out.
I would love to. Thank you very much.
That was my guest, Lex, there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest edition of the pod. I certainly hope it's been a pleasant distraction for you in these trying times. Also, if you like what you heard, remember the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Finally, be sure to join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!